Hello, everybody, and welcome to this week's edition of the Perceptive Podcast. I am Josh Placer, Game Wisdom's owner and lead writer. Joining me this week, my co-host, Game Wisdom's site designer and artist for Smugby Games, Kenneth Ohm.
Yo.
And our returning guest for 4to3.com, Jason McMaster.
Hello.
So, how's everyone's week been so far?
A little long.
Yeah, I mean, you know, packing, gonna be moving soon, so, a lot of that fun stuff.
Where are you moving to?
I'm from Birmingham, Alabama, originally. I'm moving back, my parents are kinda getting up there, and I'm gonna go spend some time with them and make sure they're okay.
Okay, well, that's
nice. I mean, you know, it's not glorious, but it's something I feel I should do.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Alright, so my news of the week is about the Gas Powered Games Kickstarter for Wildman. For those of you who listened last week, we brought this up then, and we all had reservations on it. We were interested in the design. And apparently what happened over the weekend, it was revealed that the studio let go of the majority of their employees, and I believe they're down to, I think, 3 or 4, counting the owner, Chris Taylor. And he put up, like, a very emotional video talking about why he had to let everyone go. And he was even considering canceling the whole Kickstarter and letting the company just die right then and there. And he did receive a lot of support from the backers, and now they're keeping the Kickstarter up. And at the time of this recording, they are just over $300,000 on their way to their $1.1 million goal. So, have you guys ever, like, heard of anything like this happening, but the company just letting everyone go like this?
Yeah. That happens all the time.
Yeah, but they don't usually do a Kickstarter afterwards.
Yeah. It's definitely...
Who did they keep?
I don't think they actually reported on the Kickstarter. I know, of course, Chris is still there.
I have some friends that work there. I just wonder if Steve Bauman still works there. He was there... like writer, is that designer?
I think I read some of that he was one of the guys let go, but I don't know if they brought him back after the more support for the Kickstarter itself.
Yeah,
I was under the assumption that they were going to hire more, you know, when the Kickstarter finished, if they were successful. So I mean, there's always that hope.
Yeah, but that video, that was definitely a little hard to watch. What do you guys think?
Yeah, I mean, I posted on our own site about it. I wholeheartedly understand what he's probably going through. And we heard about it through Arson Games when we had that podcast. In all the trials you have to go through when developing a game and creating your own studio and maintaining it and maintaining your employees and making it successful and dealing with all the press and, you know, your own fans. It's a lot of work. And you could see all that. He's just putting it all out there for everyone to see. His true feelings and his true reasoning. And I think that's great. You should be open about those kind of things. People should know what you're going through. Or they won't give you any breaks.
I had my own company, and we had to let everybody go, so I know what it feels like. It's a really terrible feeling. For him, for being honest, you know, and it's not something you enjoy doing, you know, because, like, when you hire people, sometimes they're your friends beforehand, sometimes they are afterwards, and you're always, like, letting go people you like, and they, you know, they, like, depend on you for things, and you enjoy working with them. It's a very terrible feeling, so, I certainly feel for him.
Well, I mean, and he also talked about his reasoning of why he did the layoffs, because if he didn't do that, then they wouldn't get any sort of severance. So instead of gambling with her severance packages, he decided to give them some money instead of no money in case the game itself would fail. And it is already super risky with, you know, what he's trying to pitch. So yeah. I think he was very responsible. And I know I have a lot of respect for the guy. And I also have a lot of respect for the guys at Arson too.
Definitely a complete turnaround from, you know, the War Z developers and all the crap they try to pull.
Well, they're just evil. I mean, they're like the Zynga of Bob zombie mods.
Very specific Zynga mod there.
But it's a as long as people understand.
Yes. No, I got you. I got you.
Yeah, getting back to what you were saying a few minutes ago, Kenneth, about the challenges of what we talk about with Arkane, with being an independent developer. I mean, every day we talk about how great it must be to be an indie developer. You know, you're your own boss, you can do what you want. But on the flip side, there's the fact that there's no one providing you with a steady paycheck. You don't have a publisher fronting the costs, so when you fail, you're pretty much, you know, losing your own money. There's no safety net there.
Well, it's also really scary in terms of how much freedom you have. Because when you have a publisher, you have strict deadlines, you need to answer to all these people. When you're an indie developer, you answer to yourself. So you explore a lot of different ideas that could be great, but then they usually end up like sputtering off, or you're demotivated or whatever. So it's hard. That's why we hear a lot of silence from big indie developers, because they're working on, you know, their own brainstorming thought processes of other IPs and titles, because they don't want to keep doing the same kind of thing, you know?
Yeah.
So you become your own worst enemy, pretty much, in indie development.
Well, honestly, it's most businesses you start. Like, if it's something you want to do, and it's cool, you get to be your own boss and everything. Then after a while, you start to realize, yeah, being your own boss is great, but there's so much pressure, so much so much required of you that you never really think about before. It's certainly in there. It can be tough. Very tough. It's great if you're doing it and you're successful. It's awesome at that point.
Yeah.
But otherwise, yeah.
Oh, yeah, don't forget, you know, you have your own responsibilities, but when you start hiring people, then you're responsible for them also. So that's that's a ton of pressure.
If you're the worst. Company.
And it's definitely hard to, like, break your mindset. You are one of those guys who either have to have someone telling you what to do all the time, or if you are, you know, like that free spirit, trying to switch your whole personality, your work ethic around, can be very difficult for a lot of people.
Right, and especially the people that are, like, perfectionists, you know? They want everything to be, like, at a certain level of quality. And, you know, when they try to reach it, they start to lose sight of the macro, the whole, like, you know, it's not feasible what they're doing. Like, example, in that podcast with Arson, he said that his one friend worked on, the main menus and UI stuff before the core game mechanics. And he kind of, like, lost sight of what was important, and he lost a lot of money by, you know, focusing on the nitty-gritty stuff instead of the big stuff.
Sure. I mean, that's the first rule, is that if you don't have a fun game, there's nothing, you know, what are you going to do? You know, you can't have, like, the most awesome menu system in the world knowing you will care. You know?
Yeah, and he wasn't even a trained, like, designer or artist, so, you know, just, it's like, oh, this looks good.
That expression, you can't see the forest for the trees, could apply.
Yeah, absolutely.
And we also, going back to perfectionists, there's, of course, the example about Duke Nukem Forever and all the stories that came out of the studio about how, like, every time the designer saw, you know, some kind of new technology or some kind of new gameplay, he wanted, you know, drop everything and add that to the game.
That's supposedly true, too. Yeah, I've interviewed some of those guys. There was a lot of that stuff going on, I think, with that game. That was, like, just the craziest story ever. At a certain point, I think they just got themselves where they were stuck. You know, like, there was no way they could really finish a game and release it, but there was also, like, no way they could get out of being the assholes that were making a game for, like, 12 years. That 3D Realms is one screwed up freaking company. So, we'll just leave it at that.
Well, they did leave a legacy, though. That everyone will remember. Sure.
Yeah, no one's ever going to forget that catastrophe.
Yeah, I mean, they're now a reference for life, you know? They want to be Duke Nukem Forever.
Ask Gearbox how much they like Duke Nukem Forever. I'm sure they love it right now.
I'm sure that's a stain in their portfolio.
Mm. Oh, yeah. Yeah, no, it's a bad one, too. Like, it's so funny. Borderlands 2 is so great. And, you know, they did what? Like, about Blue Shift and all that for Half-Life? Mm-hmm. Something like that.
They did, I think, Opposing Force, I think, too.
And I really liked Opposing Force as well, for Counter-Strike, right?
Mm-hmm. No, next time you introduce Gearbox, be like, oh, from the makers of Duke Nukem Forever, Borderlands. Go on from there. Make sure that's first.
Oh, yeah. Well, yeah, no, they do like that, I hear. Big fans, especially the Jim Redner. Was it Jim Redner Group? Yeah, they're probably big fans of Duke Nukem as well after...
You know, they re-released the game, and it was an adventure game. There's like no shooting at all. It was Duke Nukem solves, mysteries using his misogyny. Perfect.
That would be pretty perfect. No, I mean, I reviewed Duke Nukem, and that was one of the hardest games I've ever had to play for a review in my entire life.
Whenever I see anyone play that game on Steam, I always ask them why. I don't know, even if I haven't talked to them in years, I'll just ask them why. Why that game? Tell me why.
It's not even worth it. At any point, to play through that game, it's not worth it for the experience. It's not worth it for anything. It is the worst thing I have played.
You can slap boobs on a wall, though.
I spent $2 on that game.
I had a review copy, thank God.
Someone actually has sent me a message on Steam saying, "What the hell is wrong with you? Why are you playing that?"
That was me. I think.
It's so awful. It is like the worst game. I can't say that enough.
We could probably talk the rest of the podcast about that, I think.
I don't know, and that's quite the same thing, the worst game, because there's a lot of worse games out there.
Well, okay, I mean, you know, the worst recent game, I can say E.T. was really a piece of shit, too. I had it, and it was so freaking awful that... But, you know, when you're that age, you'll just play just about anything, no matter how terrible it is when you're a kid.
What do you think is worse, a game that is just, really bad like Duke Nukem, or a game that you were, really hyped up for and super disappointed in?
I would say the second. I would say really hyped up or disappointed in is much worse.
Yeah, for some reason, I don't hate Duke Nukem Forever as such a high quality as Dragon Age 2. I know Dragon Age 2 is a good game, but it was just so far away from the quality of the originals, like Dragon Age Origins. And even the expansion was way better than the sequel, somehow. The sequel just felt like it was rushed, and it was just, their design choices were just for saving time. They have
it came out of nowhere, their design flip.
Yeah, I don't know. We were talking about it earlier before the podcast, and it still makes my heart sink a little bit thinking about that game. But
alright.
Well, you know what? Even though people like using hyperboles and stuff, the worst game, for sure, for me, and I'm always going to repeat this in the podcast when I can, Final Fantasy XIV Original Launch. The worst game I've ever played. I repeat on the podcast before. It was if I'm serious, in the future, if they have, in college courses, I want them to have a class on Final Fantasy XIV, Worst Launch in History, 101 class. It should be like a series. And they should take each mechanic and just go through it.
My least favorite game of all time, I bet neither of you have actually ever heard of this one, Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde for the Nintendo.
Oh, that's real famous because of AVGN. Mm-hmm. As his worst game of all time.
Oh. That was just a horrible game.
I don't know. I can't imagine it being that much worse than, like, Avoid the Noid or E.T. But,
Avoid the Noid. Cool Spot was actually a pretty good game, talking about, like, corporate tie-in games.
Oh, the 7-Up, the 7-Up one?
Yeah.
When I was a kid, I actually made a little poster of the Cool Spot character, and I asked my parents to get the game for me, because I thought it was that cool. But I guess it was... Was that cool?
I see where you're going.
Yeah. Look, there was a surfboard. He was on a surfboard. How cool can you?
You do not get much cooler than that. I'll give you that. I mean, I guess until maybe he got a little bit older and he would be smoking and wearing a leather jacket.
I think he had a leather jacket. That doesn't make any sense, though, because he's just a giant circle. But anyways.
All right, let's move from... 7-Up back to Wild Man. That's a great jump, by the way.
Alright.
So one part that we keep hearing about is that people are saying that, you know, it's just publicity stunt, you know, they didn't really let anyone go. And they're saying that it's going to hurt the Kickstarter. I don't know. I think the fact that he had the integrity to basically come out honestly and say the problem, I think does help him in some regard. But on the other hand, it does leave us questioning, you know, how many more updates can they do with the Wild Man prototype? Because without, you know, a huge team, how are they going to, you know, update, you know, more game footage and do more work to the game in the meantime?
Well, they're promising that when the Kickstarter is successful, they'll hire the people back. So I'm sure they'll be putting all their time in promotional materials, getting people just the free help just to come in, stuff like that, to get this stuff off the ground. Because, you know, if these people really do want their jobs back and really love the company, you know, they'll help out any way they can. And I think the community themselves, like, there is the naysayers of, like, oh, just a giant cash grab, you know, whatever. But I really feel like this guy is pretty honest. And he just did an AMA on Reddit, you know, asking a bunch of questions. And I think it's hosted on their site, too. Answers and questions. Or questions and answers.
Mm-hmm.
So, Anna, I would still donate to him.
Oh, yeah. See, I don't know. I don't think it's going to hurt him that bad. You know? Like, them coming out and telling the truth is the best thing they could do. If it were, for some reason, to come out, like, that it was a total hoax, then, yeah, that's going to totally suck.
Mm-hmm.
But
War Z it?
Yeah, but if not, then I think, you know, I think it'll work out really well for them in the end. Because, you know, people like Chris Taylor, you know, and Kickstarter can do a lot of crazy things.
Look at FTL, man. It was a game that was only, yep. They don't ask for $2,000, they got millions for it, and selling like hotcakes is super addictive, so.
I kickstarted that one.
I regret not kickstarting Oculus Rift. That was my mistake.
I did Double Fine.
Yeah, me too.
I got the shirt and all that.
I actually look for small projects too. Like, there was this author who was just, she wanted to make a book. I'm like, here's $40. Then I kind of get her a hardcover book.
Yeah, you know, I love Kickstarter. I think it's really cool. You just, like, have to ferret out what's really good.
Well, you still get things from it. So, like, yeah. When he's not just throwing it away. You are
right.
You are receiving some sort of reward, which is great, and you're part of the production, and you know you vote with your money. That's the best way of going.
Yeah, no, I agree.
So, Jason, what news do you have for us this week?
It's kind of interesting. Atari has filed for Chapter 11, but they are doing so in an attempt to separate themselves from their parent company, Atari SA. And realign themselves as a digital producer and content creation house. So that could be pretty interesting. They're arguing that they are being roundly ignored by their parent company and not receiving support from them. So they want to sell off all of their properties or whatever to get capital to reform as a separate company from Atari SA.
So we could buy Pong then?
Yeah, I guess so, you know, or something much worse, something that no one will want.
Hmm.
Oh, God, I got to think about it. I need to look through the papers.
What Atari? Don't they have a license with D&D? No, it's not them. What is it?
That's Wizards of the Coast, and it's, yeah, it's Wizards of the Coast owns it, but who has the, God, who does have the license? It's,
Hasbro, maybe?
What?
I think Hasbro's owns Wizards now or something. Or Wizards owns Hasbro or something weird like that.
I don't think Hasbro is owned by... That'd be crazy if that was the truth. If Hasbro was owned by Wizards of the Coast.
It might actually be. Let me see.
That'd be, I want to know. Okay, just look it up. I want to know.
Sure. Now, my memory may be failing, but didn't Atari file for bankruptcy before, like, sometime in the 90s?
Yeah, they did.
Okay.
Yeah, and then they were purchased by Infogrames, and Infogrames made changed their name to Atari because nobody gives a shit about Infogrames. So,
changed his name to Atari SA. And Infogrames, they were the ones who originally created Alone in the Dark, right?
Oh, sweet.
Back,
yeah. Huh. Oh, wait, no, yeah, it's Hasbro owns Wizards, right? I knew it was one of them.
Okay. It's like, there's no way that Hasbro, that huge company, would be owned by Wizards of the Coast somehow.
Which, what's weird is, like, Hasbro bought out, I'm a big board game fan, Hasbro's bought out a bunch of, like, older board game companies, too, so they produce stuff like Cosmic Encounters and stuff, or who, no, someone else bought it from Hasbro, that's right, it was Fantasy Flight, I think, does Cosmic Encounters now. Strange. Anyway.
No, well, there's a big rise in board games now, especially independent board games.
Oh, yeah, no, it's been crazy. I've produced some videos for a couple that have been kickstarted, and, helped like with some of the testing of some, and they're a lot of fun, and they're really popular now.
Yeah, I'm actually producing a card game with another client.
Oh, that's cool.
It's a noir card game.
And yeah, is it, or can you talk about it? I'm curious.
I'll tell you after the cast, but yeah.
Okay.
The point is it's a noir card game, so it's an awesome premise. We have it all fleshed out, and it's in the middle of testing. So
awesome.
We're hoping to produce it in the next few months, depending on the schedule.
Card games are really hip now.
We'll send you a copy.
Oh, that'd be awesome. Yeah, I'd love to check that out. I can. That'd be great.
Hmm. And so, is there anything like big going on besides them falling for Chapter 11? Say they're trying to sell Pong, Asteroid, Centipede. Hmm.
Right, yeah, a lot of the classic properties. So.
You want to hear a weird story with Pong? So there was an Atari competition, and the winner got, like, you know, a couple $1,000s, and, you know, you would be released with, like, some sort of Pong, like, compilation, right?
Yeah.
And our company, Smugby Games, actually got into the finals for that competition, and we were one of the only two companies in Philadelphia that got picked for that, us and Island Officials, actually, I think they're in New Jersey, but in the area, you know what I mean. So, it was us and Island Officials in it, and we got to, like, the top 10, and then we got axed at the very last round, and we're like, and it's called Pong Slice. We actually have a video online through Atari YouTube.
That's awesome.
Our game. Just check it out. It's pretty cool. It's a game where you draw your own paddles. That's how you play.
Oh, that's really awesome.
And I made a really sweet video for it that I made within a day, so check it out.
I will check that out.
I'll post it. We'll talk about it after the podcast also. All right. I'm just saying, I wonder what's going to happen to the competition now. I mean, I wonder if what happens if they didn't actually pay out to the winners. I don't even know who the winner was. But I don't know what's going to happen to those games and all the entries, because every entry that went in, they own the rights to. So maybe Smugby can buy Pong Slice back. Like, we care.
There you go. Totally should.
We don't care. We need a Pong Slice. That's how lame we are.
And I guess there's a side story about another company with issues in terms of bankruptcy. Another piece of news is about THQ. They're going to auction off some of their game properties today. And South Park is they're having trouble being allowed to sell off the rights to the South Park game. According to news, it has to do with the fact that THQ doesn't own the actual license for South Park, I think.
No, they don't.
South Park Studios does, right?
Yeah. So, yeah, they're going to have a little problem with that, I guess, unless it's approved. You know, honestly, if they really want, why doesn't Matt and Trey just take over that game, realistically? That seems like something they should just hire a team, put it out themselves. It's not like they don't have the money.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, they. I'm sure there's some love for that game, too. They put hours and hours of their life into it, all that voice recording, all that writing. I'm sure they want it, too.
It looks really great, too. It's supposed to be mostly finished, isn't it? I mean,
yeah.
It was supposed to come out in a couple of months.
March.
Yeah. I was really looking forward to that. I hope we still see it.
That would be quite a tragedy if it didn't come out, you know?
Yeah, I agree. That would be one for the ages.
That was the highlight to the E3 conference, was that
game. Yeah, Matt and, Yeah, Matt and Trey showing up and seeming uninterested.
Well, that saved Microsoft, though. Looking completely lame.
So, oh, yeah. Yeah, I agree.
According to the news piece, they said that they have that South Park Films have the rights to buy the game back itself, and according to the report, THQ owes them $2.2 million, and they haven't paid to the South Park developers. I wonder what's going to happen with that, because it definitely sounds like an interesting game.
I agree, yeah. Isn't it Obsidian that's doing it?
Yeah.
They always make, to me, I love Obsidian. You know, they always make, like, critically acclaimed games, but, like, financial flop games. Like, I really love Alpha Protocol. I really love that game.
I'm not a huge fan, but, like, most of my friends are. I guess I couldn't get past the action sequences, but I do appreciate, like, the role-playing stuff. It's really cool in that game.
I mean, the ramifications, we were pretty severe for your choices. I actually really love that.
When
we're talking about the posts or later, I'll bring up that game again, because that's actually a good example of what we're talking about.
Okay. Yeah. You know, New Vegas as well. I mean, they did a pretty good job of that. So, I mean,
oh, yeah, excellent. Definitely. Yeah. Like, them and I love them, BioWare. Because usually Obsidian was known for just picking up BioWare's titles afterwards and making sequels. But either way, they were very good.
They're like, they're always like, BioWare's like B Team.
Like yeah. They were BioWare's B Team. They were the Osmond to the Weezer. What do you know? Those bands. Anyways.
Alright. So what news do you have for us, guys?
Always putting me on the spot.
Mm-hmm.
So, I was actually going to talk about the one that you're going to talk about, so we could talk about maybe that Jay Wilson has stepped down from Diablo 3. And that guy is,
I don't think a lot of people are going to be that upset about that, really.
Actually, everyone that saw that post were just cheering. They're like, yeah, they're like, F that loser.
A lot of people are not horribly fond of the old Diablo 3.
Well, this is what, so if everyone knows, just to give everyone context. So Jay Wilson is the director, was the director for Diablo 3. And, the reason all this hate goes to him, and how everything's blamed on that guy, is that on a Facebook post, one of the designers was talking about an interview from the original Diablo creator, Diablo 1-2. And he was just giving a critique of like how he would envision Diablo 3 and, and he was just, being constructive, it was just an interview. And, he made a sad face, posted about it, and all the people started, like, railing against this guy, and everyone making a point. And then simply, Jay Wilson just says, F that loser.
Yeah.
And in that thread, too, because he was part of that thread, there's a lot of other ignorant comments, like, they're all like, well, you know what, Diablo 3 was the fastest PC game selling game of all time. Like, what has he got? Hellgate London. I'm like,
I wonder what. So he's talking to Bill Rover. Yeah. Okay. So yeah, I wonder why Diablo 3 was the fastest selling game of all time. Was it your commercial?
Yeah, I think that was it. I think it was because Diablo 3 is an original game, right? It's an original IP.
Oh yeah.
No other games came before it. They just put it on there for fun.
It was the real money auction house. Everyone loved that.
Yeah.
We all wanted spend money to acquire virtual items.
Yes, it was ingenious all around. But I'm just saying that. Just saying, like, oh, well, great. What did we make? Hellgate London. Dude, he also made Diablo 1 and 2, you douche. Come on.
Yeah. Diablo 2 is, like, one of the best-selling computer games of all time. I can't imagine. Like, overall,
He wasn't being childish about it, but everyone in that thread was being childish about it. And just not sensible. Let's stop right here, because I need the sound is broken. Anyways, so back on the Diablo rant here. So Jay Wilson stepped down as director of Diablo 3. But he hasn't been fired or anything. He's just been placed onto an unannounced Blizzard project. That's all. But still, people are, like, dancing in the streets. They're like, screw that guy. King's dead. Blah, blah, blah. So,
Announce if there's who's going to be the new director for the game? who's going to lead the charge now?
No idea. They didn't actually say it, so all that we know is that he's just being moved to a different project. And we don't know if it's about it because of his lack of ability, or because they see he has a great ability, or we have no details at all.
Well, I'll tell you this. I think that the guy, he came in, what, like the original Diablo 3 producer left like a little bit before it came out, right?
Yes.
And then this guy comes in, and they make a bunch of radical changes to the game. I think they screwed some of it up. However, they have done a lot of work in patches and stuff like that since the game came out to make it different. And good for him and everything, but yeah, I don't see how you can come in, like, not even after being the lead designer for, like, very little at the entire life of the game, you know, or when you compare it to the entire life of the game, and then say that Bill Roper sucks or whatever. I just don't understand that.
Yeah.
Well, he said it a lot cruder than that. That was the problem. Like, not only
well,
did
right.
He could have said, you know, he has his own opinions, but blah, 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 and just go on and explain it in some sort of delicate way. Mm-hmm. But instead, he just says, F that loser, like some sort of immature, you know.
Yeah.
Well, yeah, that loser now works for Disney, so, I mean, I don't know if he's that much loser, you know. He had a couple of bad times, like, you know, sure, Hellgate London, it was cool design, they screwed themselves with stupid modification, and then, you know, he worked on, what was it, Champions? Online.
Yeah, that's still going.
And then Star Trek Online, I think he also worked on. And stuff like that. So I don't, you know, I don't really see, it's either Champions or Heroes, I don't know. But, like, yeah, he didn't, he hasn't done that bad for himself. I don't know what that guy's talking about. It's one of those sad little childish, you know.
Well, again, he didn't think anyone would see it, which is pretty stupid. Because if you're in the public eye, you're posting on someone's wall about another person within your field. You just don't do that. You don't.
Right.
So it was his, you know, lack of experience or lack of foresight that caused this. But anyways, that's pretty much the news that I have, is that that guy stepped down and people are like, yay, but he's just moving on to different projects. People are like, oh.
As you know, quick sign of that. No, there was a similar case, well, at least a lot happier story that happened last year when the original designer for XCOM, he actually wrote like a little piece about the new XCOM game at the time, and he went into detail about what he liked and what he didn't like, and we didn't see, you know, any flame mails from Jake Solomon on that one.
Yeah,
no, I mean, it's you take it as well, you're going to take it, you know, I mean, it's just like, You can't be that thin-skinned.
Of course.
If you're a game designer, specifically one working for Blizzard, and specifically one that has such a large game. I don't, you know, it's something you have to learn when you start being in public, is that not everybody's going to like you, and not everybody's going to think you're a precious snowflake. You know, not everybody's going to tell you that everything you do is great. So, I don't know, just whatever. He needs to grow up some.
Yeah.
I mean, you have to just take, and especially if it's if a professional critique of it, that's even less of a reason to be angry about it.
Yeah.
Because he's giving you valid points for each of his reasons. He's not just saying, oh, game's slow, I hate Red. And it's like saying this random generic information.
Yeah.
He's being very specific. He's giving his reasons. And he's doing it on a professional platform. So I don't think there's anything wrong with that.
Definitely.
Yeah. Silly.
Oh. Yeah, I like that. End case. Silly.
That's a good point to end on that note. All right. So, let's talk about some of the games we've been playing. For myself, I've been getting into King's Bounty Warriors of the North. This is, I believe it's technically the third game of the series that's been out for the last few years. And it's part of the poster we'll be talking about later and upcoming analysis. For the people out there who aren't familiar, King's Bounty is a strategy mixed with some RPG elements type design. You have like the big overworld, you run around, and then when you have the battles, they're transformed into these like tactical battles between your army and the enemy's army. And what's very interesting about the series is that you have a case where they're trying to be both linear and non-linear. The actual path through the game and the enemies you fight are always going to be the same each time you play, but the stores where you can acquire new units and new equipment are randomized. And it does a lot to really mix up your strategies, because each of the units has, like, different abilities, they belong to different species, like, you can't have, like, undead and humans can't work together, because undead, you know, they like to eat humans. And what's great about the series is that it really has a great mix of giving you, like, that RPG progression with the depth of these turn-based battles. But the problem I have with the third one is that this is the, of course, the third game. They're still using the same engine, the same design, and it's starting to get a little bit repetitive. I was talking to Ken before the podcast. He just started playing the original King's Battle, the Legend. And how are you finding that so far?
Well, I actually find it very enjoyable because I really love Might and Magic 3, and it's just like that entirely. So I didn't even mean, I owned the game for a long time. I had no idea, sadly, that it was like Might and Magic. And I kept looking at the GOG sales. I'm like, oh man, the Might and Magic pack. I haven't played a game like it since. I want it. And then here's King's Bounty doing the same thing. I'm like, oh geez, I had this whole time? So now I'm like playing the hell out of it right now. I just spent 3 hours playing it today.
Mm-hmm. He was watching me play the third one this whole week. I finally got him to install the first one.
Yeah, this is what happens. I stalk what you're playing. Like, Josh, what do you think? How's that game going? Good? All right, I'll try it. So, that's really what happens.
Yeah, I'm definitely going to be interesting if you do decide to play through the other two series, how your impressions of them are going to change. Because while the general gameplay has remained persistent across all three, they change a lot of the pacing in the later titles. In the third one, what they do is instead of having these giant landmasses to explore, you basically explore a series of islands. So it's a lot smaller, there's a lot less room for error, which has always been one of the issues with King's Bounty, is that the difficulty can be very uneven.
For some reason I cleared this whole map, one area, and there's two mobs that are like extremely high. Mm-hmm. Like, there's one area where there's like a high wizard with like 500 of them, and I'm like, what? I just killed a snake earlier with like three of them. Three. By the way, what I'm saying is in their combat system, you have creatures that represent, you know, what's in your army, what's in the opponent's army, and there's usually a number on the bottom of the creature saying how many of them there are on the field at once. And obviously, the more you have, the stronger they are. And that's one of those like Might and Magic things that I loved. So it's great that they did King's Bounty. So just so everyone gets context, what I'm talking about with numbers and creatures, that's what it is. So yeah. I have, you know, characters with like normal numbers, like 10 soldiers, and they have 500 million high wizards. And I'm like, why? This is a starting area. Why does this exist?
Oh, it gets worse in the later games. Like, you'll come to, you'll have one island where everyone's, you know, normal or a little harder than you, and then next island, the first enemy is going to be, you know, deadly.
Great. I'm excited to play through the series now.
But I'm a huge Heroes of Might and Magic fan myself, so I haven't looked at Warriors of the North yet, but I might pick that up later.
So you played the King's Bounty series then?
I've played a little bit of the first two. Not like a ton, but I did play a bit, and yeah, I enjoy the, it's a good system. Hey, there's nothing wrong with moving pieces around.
Yeah, this is the kind of game I was actually looking for, because I kept buying games like Spellforce and King Arthur, and just getting disappointed in those games. I'm like, slow. But I was playing this one, I'm like, yeah, this is what I want.
Did you ever play Descent? Or not Descent. Not Descent. Disciples.
Disciples.
I've heard of it. I think I bought it like a
Disciples
while.
2.
Yeah, Disciples 2. I think 3's out now as well. It's very, very Heroes of Might and Magic, but it's also really hard.
sounds like my kind of game. Yeah. Because King's Bounty itself is actually pretty hard, I would say.
Yeah, no, you can get Disciples 3 for like $20 or something, so I don't know. It's I know 2's probably much cheaper. Like, yeah, $10 for 2 gold, so.
Well, I think modern games are spoiling me with levels, level systems, how they quickly you can level up through the first 10. King's Bounty, every epic battle you have is like 5 points to like a bar of 1,000. Like, oh god. Why does this not move up anymore?
Yeah.
You'll find, if you look around though, you'll find ways to get bonus experience, which is really nice.
Too lazy.
Aw.
I'm just kidding, I'll try it.
And I want to talk more about, but since it is a part of our blog post discussion later on, I'm going to end my section here. So, have you been playing anything else besides King's Bounty, Kenneth?
Yes. According to this, I started playing Assassin's Creed 3. Which is really awesome so far.
I like it.
A really, really great environment. The cities feel alive. They did a lot of research on, you know, what these towns actually look like in the old Boston and stuff.
How far have you gotten into it? Like, who are you playing as?
Let's just say I'm about to make a character switch.
Okay. All right. So you know the
yeah.
The twist. Okay. Yeah. It's really
no. Bad. You told them there's a twist. Oh no! Now they're gonna be waiting for it.
Right. Well, no. There's like 14 twists. I mean, it's an Assassin's Creed game. I mean, that's what's gonna happen. But no, not a twist. But it's like a. It's
how hard. Do like them. It's how hard. Do like them apples.
Yeah. It's hard to. Yeah. That's a great. Yeah. It's hard to. It's hard to even talk about the game, but it's something that Tom and I talked about on our podcast and how we both were like, both kind of didn't like the game up until we realized what was happening, and then we thought that was like the most awesome thing ever. So it's kind
well,
of
I'm a huge history buff. I love history, and I love American history specifically.
Well,
and I always study like U.S. presidents. So you add that with Assassin's Creed gameplay, and I'm like, hell yeah.
Oh, yeah.
So that's like, so it's really... tickling my fun spot.
Yeah, I'm horrified by that. We'll move on. but no, it's a
dirty minded.
It's okay. It's a very it's my favorite Assassin's Creed for sure.
Yeah, and I said before, like they did a really great job in the recreation of it. City feels like alive. The controls feel really fluid, and they definitely have an interesting take on the storyline. So. I'm really engrossed in the game right now, and you know, me and my girlfriend are just going through each night, just playing a few chapters. So we'll see if there's more of these mega twists you keep talking about.
It's funny just how much the Assassin's Creed series has improved. Because I remember we all played the first one, and I think most people just hated that one. It was just very boring, very simple, and those goddamn flag. Side quests of trying to find these like little tiny flags on rooftops was just maddening.
They were awful. Those were awful. The fact that you couldn't deviate from the way you were supposed to kill somebody was kind of awful, and that they made it like just really frustrating to deal with. The traveling was pretty crappy. I don't know. Yeah, it just didn't. It's a really cool game, really cool concept. It just didn't work. And then 2 came out. Good God. Like, night and day.
Yeah. I mean, that was just ridiculous, just how much of an improvement it was over the first one.
What's Revelations? Because I own that. I don't know what that is. Is that the second one, or is that some sort of in-between game, or what?
I'm confused by that myself, too.
In-between. From what I understand, I actually didn't play much of it. That's the only Assassin's Creed that I've really played through. Because I'm still playing through the Vita one. But I don't know. It just kind of, like, seemed kind of more of the same, so it didn't really do much for me. So.
Well, I just want to say Assassin's Creed 3, I also appreciate them giving more backstory and... reason for these villains, because if you can, if you can correlate, or you know, if you can understand the villains, you know, they're even more sensational when they do evil things.
Yeah.
So.
Oh yeah, no, I think that game has a lot of great villains. Now, I mean, the Desmond parts are probably less offensive than most of the other games. They're still Desmond, you know.
You're just like the most boring character. He's the Rochelle of the Assassin's Creed series, if you know what I mean. Rochelle from Left 4 Dead.
Yeah. She's just very helpful and nice, and not a lot of personality. He's just kind of like, you don't want to play those parts. This one, luckily they're not that terrible comparably, but there's one or two sequences where you're like, okay, I do not want to be Desmond anymore.
No, there's already moments where I hear him like freaking out. I'm like, shut up, Desmond.
No one cares. I think the Vita Assassin's Creed actually took a better approach to it because it doesn't have like any Desmond parts. It's just, here's a simulation you can play
through. I could strip it down to at least the beginning of the Assassin's Creed being, Daddy, you're mean. I don't like that. And I'm like, shut up, Desmond.
I assume they're working on a fourth one, or are they going to do like more like side stories for Assassin's Creed 3?
I would have to imagine that they're going to put out plenty of Assassin's Creed 3 stuff, because I'm sure they got that DLC, the Tyrannical Washington thing, coming out.
that's a cool idea, by the way.
I thought so, too.
Reality. George Washington, in this scenario, he seizes control and becomes king of America.
he's a tyrant. Yeah, that's like the greatest concept. by French people. I imagine that they'll probably use the engine again before the next Xbox and PlayStation. I can imagine seeing one more Assassin's Creed like game. But I will say, I'm not gonna ruin it for you. Assassin's Creed 4, it's coming. And I do not know what to say about it. So once you beat the game, we'll talk about that sometime.
I actually kind of know how it's gonna go, so I'm just saying it's definitely going to. There's definitely going to be more Assassin's Creed for sure.
Oh, yeah. I just don't know how interesting they'll be.
Well, just so you know, the Assassin's Creed 3 is the best-selling Ubisoft game, and the biggest launch for them. So there you go. They're definitely gonna make some more, and it's not a bad franchise. They're not CODing it, right? They're not just like releasing it every year with pathetic updates. They're actually putting it in different environments and settings and creating a rich narrative for each. So I think that this progression of the series is actually really good.
I think they're one of the more interesting companies for 2013. And what's sad, another super interesting company for 2013 is THQ. But that's not working out. But for them, they have Watch Dogs, which I really want to see. Watch Dogs looks pretty awesome.
Doesn't Capcom have Remember Me coming out? They're supposed to be like similar. It's different. It's definitely a different kind of thing, though. One feels more GTA-ish, and the other one feels more Capcom-ish.
Yeah.
That makes any sense to you.
No, it does. I mean, I love Capcom. Big Capcom fan.
I love some of the demo videos of it, but then sometimes I hear the main character's dialogue. It's like, who am I? I'm like, oh, no, Capcom.
Yeah.
you and your amnesia stories.
Oh, yeah. Oh, there you are, Capcom. They're pretty rough.
The environment's so cool, and the futuristic environment, I mean, the atmosphere is awesome. But I feel like it's going to be bogged down with bad, like, broken writing. So we'll see how that actually plays out.
Well, I mean, it's a Capcom game. I mean, you got, like, a 50-50 on it, you know.
I think it's a French studio, though, so I'm sure the, you know, cinematography and all that stuff's going to be great. And the pieces that I saw were really, you know, had a lot of ingenuity to it. I'm just hopefully it's not broken up with the "Who am I?" thing all the time and crying, and I don't know. The character always seems very melodramatic, so I'm like, oh, I hate melodrama. I like subtlety.
I mean, if we're talking Capcom, you're probably not going to get a lot of that. I mean, they're like so famously very Japanese in their writing and design. And that is not subtle.
But they're known for a really... They are known for their awesome gameplay, though.
Sure. I like most of the games they've released in the last few years, though I didn't play Resident Evil 6.
Well, no. So it's developed by... What? Don't Nod Entertainment? It's a weird name. But they're published by Capcom. So it's not really Capcom that's making them. They're just publishing them. So it's not... But maybe the writing's going to be good then.
Well, you know, if that company does well enough, Capcom might buy them. I mean, that's kind of what they do, you know? Like, they bought Blue Castle and stuff like that after Left 4 Dead.
Well, you know, we were all surprised, like, Deus Ex Human Revolution was excellent.
Rising, Left 4 Dead was Valve.
Dead Rising. Yeah, Dead Rising 2 was Blue Castle, and then they got... Capcom's kind of a powerhouse studio, and they're, I would argue, probably the most relevant powerhouse studio in Japan right now.
Well, Square Enix did release one awesome game, at least the Deus Ex Human Revolution, I said earlier.
And
that was a big surprise.
Yeah. Square, like, they publish a lot of okay stuff.
Well, yeah, I think that was, like, better than okay, though. I think they did the IP justice, except for those boss battles. They were stupid.
Well, that's what killed it for me. I think got to a point where I just couldn't get through, like, one of the boss battles. I was like, yeah, I'm done with this.
No, just take the Typhoon thing and do it 3 times. It kills all the bosses, no matter what they do. I kept it along just for those reasons. I'm like, oh, I'll put some stupid points in it so I can kill these dumb bosses. What they did was they outsourced to a different studio the boss battles. And I guess they did no research on Deus Ex at all.
Yeah,
and that was it.
Why would you outsource boss battles? I don't want to know.
That boggles. We should have, like, one day we should have, like, a list of questions you want to ask studios.
Yeah.
Like, why? The decisions they made.
That's like outsourcing your inventory system or something. I just don't get it. It's, like, such an integral part of your game. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I mean, again, Deus Ex, you can just stealth past them. You don't even have to have a fight. That's the point. It has to match what you've been doing the entire game. You can't be out of left field like that. And just so you guys know, the reason the boss battles were broken in Deus Ex is it could force you into combat. And let's say you put all your points in stealth, well, then you're standing there pretty, trying to hide from someone that can easily see through you.
Yeah.
And there's no place to hide.
And that was the biggest problem I had with those boss battles, because I was not... I was playing a Deus Ex game. I was not playing a Doom.
Yeah.
So I did not, like, build my guy to be, like, some sort of shotgun-toting maniac. I made him a hacker. Hackers aren't good at fighting giant dudes in body armor with, like, miniguns. Yeah, it just doesn't make sense.
Great trailer, by the way, too. But, yeah, I want to bring this game up, too, in the next section of the post. So why don't we move on from this and talk about your game, Fane.
Oh, me?
Yes.
All right. Well, my game I've been playing a couple of things, but I've only been... I feel that I have to talk about the one that Josh and I have been playing. And I feel maybe I could even talk about it later with our subject, but I'll go ahead and bring it up now. I have been playing Need for Speed Most Wanted. I got... lately, it was just pretty cool in its own way. If you like, you know, just holding a accelerate trigger and crashing into everything until you win a race. I mean, it's certainly one of those games. It's a propelled rocket skate kind of thing. It's just like bizarre. The game that Josh and I have been playing together a lot lately is Borderlands 2, which we had already played through once before. But now several DLC packs have come out, and we wanted to try those out. And Josh wanted to try the Mechromancer, which might not... and that's what I'm talking about that I could probably talk about later on, too, in game-breaking mechanics.
I know. I just saw one yesterday.
Oh, my God. In fact, I will save that part. However, we have been playing... we just finished Captain Scarlet's Pirate's Booty, and it was pretty cool. I mean, what did you think of it, Josh?
I thought it was all right. I like the vehicle, like the hover sandbar type thing.
It's all Return of the Jedi looking from Tatooine.
Knowing them, it's probably a direct reference.
I wish they would, like, figure out to add more... war points between their different DLC areas, because it's just annoying to, you know, have, like, a quest that's, like, 3 areas back to have to turn in, and then you have to go back 3 more areas to, you know, the next part of it.
So that's one of the things I hate about Borderlands 2, was the having to backtrack.
Yeah.
Again, we use that Guild Wars system, I'm like, ah. Oh.
And it's also, say this, though, it is better than Borderlands 1 at it, so...
Oh my god.
Borderlands 1 was like a total nightmare, backtracking back and forth, back and forth. But yeah, so We did that one. I will say I played a little bit of the Carnage or Torx, whatever, like the whatever it's called. Torx.
The wrestler one.
Campaign of Carnage or whatever. Yeah, that one. Yeah.
The Macho Man Randy Savage.
Right. Exactly. God rest his soul.
He saved us from the apocalypse.
I've been playing through that, and it's got a little bit, like, I guess more checkpoints than I would say Captain Scarlet's. And we haven't really touched the third one yet, but no, I've enjoyed it. I mean, the voice acting is still up there. They still, a lot of production value in the DLC, which is good. They seem to really care about the Borderlands franchise, which is really good for people that like it.
I was just thinking about earlier today, man, like that, talking about DRM and stuff like that, but that a game like that encourages co-op multiplayer.
Yeah.
Like that's its own system, so I don't know. I think they did a great job with that game and all around.
Borderlands 2 is probably my game of the year for last year. It just really did it for me. I'm really excited about playing through some more of the DLC later. That's certainly my game of the week.
You know what game they shouldn't make multiplayer? Train Simulator. They shouldn't make that multiplayer. That'd be awesome. I'd love someone to be the train. I'll just be a passenger, just waiting.
Sitting
there. I get points for sitting and waiting.
See people simulate those math problems. Train leaves a station at 25 miles an hour. Another train does it at 45. At what time will they both collide with each other? You could finally solve those questions.
Awesome. You know what I'm going to do, guys? This weekend, this Monk Beat team, we're going to Pittsburgh for a game jam.
Yeah.
And I'm just going to pitch that to them. I'm like, all right, guys, no matter what the scenario, let's make Train Simulator multiplayer. Let's do it.
That's it. Do it, man.
Let's see if they all take the bait. I guess not, though. But I'll try anyways. I'm like, guys, I know they said fire flowers as the concept to build the game around, but I think trains.
How about
multiplayer?
How about
stick with me.
A train line called the fire flower.
There you go. Yeah.
Exactly.
And then you just ride it all night long, like life is a highway.
Exactly. It's its own metaphor, guys.
It really is.
It makes sense.
Mm-hmm.
People will love it. People love trains, right? Exactly. And they'll love this prototype.
And have you seen the Train Simulator video, right?
Off the rails.
Yes.
That one.
Yeah.
The one with the wub-wubs.
Yes. Yeah. That's I mean, that's really all you need to show people. Get them excited. Yeah.
I own it. I own Train Simulator. I bought it on sale on Impulse Buy.
I have it too.
They should make they also have that zombie DLC also to get. All does is make it fast into zombies.
Oh yeah, wasn't there some weird missions that came with it or something too? Where you
I have no idea, but I would love it.
I'm just looking on Steam right now about Train Simulator 3. They have $2,066 worth of DLC you can buy.
Yes, they do, my friend.
Oh my goodness.
All right, I'll get it to you for a gift. All right.
Yeah, no, it's funny. The reason I know that, Josh, is that every time they have a sale, I always go and look at it because it's on sale for $400. And you're like, yes, what? No. But,
Well, the question you have to ask yourself, do you love trains that much?
You really got to want it.
Yeah, I mean, you have to. If you're willing to dedicate all that money to it, you're showing your dedication to trains, and you love trains.
But then what happens if they do Train Simulator 2014, and they have $4,000 more for the DLC?
Right. Well, yeah, and it should all be non-compatible.
Wait,
that's all I want.
Got anyone else hear a weird sound in the background?
Oh, that was me for a second. I was washing my hands.
Okay. Where are you?
My kitchen.
Oh.
Okay.
Going back to Borderlands 2, one thing we'll also have to try is that they kept adding, I think, raid content. When you reach, level 30 or level 50 on the second play, they have, the super extra hard bosses you can play that you can get, money to buy, special weapons.
Oh, yeah, you know, that's, Yeah, didn't we get like a level 30 quest or something at the end of that thing? Yeah, and I know there's like the level 50 or whatever quest you get at the end of the game or something. Yeah, no, that's pretty weird. I also like that you could apparently take that Leviathan quest again, too. Yeah, unless you just said that. I missed it. But, you can take that again and, like, go do the treasure room thing, I guess, which was a pretty cool treasure room for our level. So.
Yeah, that was nice.
Yeah, there was a few good things in there. Still haven't found any good sniper rifles, which is, like, the curse of Borderlands.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's like you play through that game, if you're looking for a sniper rifle, you get, like, crap, 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 and then you get, like, the greatest sniper rifle on the face of the earth, and you use that for the rest of the game.
Yeah.
It's just, like, the strangest thing.
Yeah.
I think people grow an affinity towards their weapons that they find.
Yeah.
You know, so.
Yeah, it's the Mechomancer. It's weird because you have, like, her ability, her anarchy power, that each time you kill an enemy, you become less accurate, but you do more damage. So last time we played it so long to a point that I had like over 150 stacks of that. So I was just like missing at point blank range with like anything I was using. It was just like fun. I'd run to someone with a shotgun, like one throw away, and I completely miss every bullet.
Yeah, no, I've been doing that recently too. Like one time I was like, "All right, you want to fight?" And then I just ran right in front of a guy shooting with a pistol, and every single one missed. I'm like, "What is going on?"
Yeah, that's so wrong.
And then, I just saw them, just hilarious. It's like it was like the Pulp Fiction scene.
Oh
like,
god!
Die you! Do. I'm like, oh, okay. Now they're all now I'm dead.
And then like my one shot, I just like grazed a guy and did like 200 times more damage than normal because I had such high anarchy from that. And
sounds like she'd be an effective assassin.
And looks like, according to some news, I think that I was reading on the Quarter 3 forum, that I think they finally announced they're going to raise the level cap. With let's see. Looks like it's level not, cap treats in March.
Yeah, it's not supposed. I don't know if they said what they're raising it to. And I know a bunch of people were excited about the Hammerlock DLC because they thought it was going to raise the level cap, but no, they said the next one. But then again, they've also said they're not sure if it's going to be part of like a separate DLC or bundled in with one. So I don't know.
Yeah, I know they raised the cap for Borderlands 1. That was actually in the DLC, the General Knox one.
Right. Yeah. Which is a good DLC, by the way.
Mm-hmm. I'm going to buy a season pass. You guys are making me jealous.
You should get a season pass. Come on, join us.
Yeah.
When next time there's a sale, I'll think about it.
Yeah, I got it from the Green Man Gaming sale. I think it was like the week or so before it came out.
Yeah, me
too. I'm an idiot. And I bought Binary Domain with my coupon instead. Like an idiot.
I certainly bought the season pass with mine. Actually, I think what their current coupon works with Borderlands stuff.
Yeah, but I used it on Chivalry, so sadness. It was worth it. By the way, I'm just going to tell you, Chivalry has a button dedicated to just battle cries. You just press it, and he goes, "Hurrah!"
Well, that's awesome. Yeah, okay.
So you could just run around just pressing that button and go, "Hurrah!" all over the place. And you actually well animated, too. So you can see all these. So when you have, like, when you just start a game, you have, like, 10 of your guys just running in one direction. They're going, "Hurrah!" Like, anybody in front of those 10 guys would freak out, like, "Oh, God, I gotta get out of here." Like, "Hurrah! Hurrah! Pull the queer!" Poor the king. Right, it's like yelling. I love it.
And I love Green Man Gaming, but it is like the hardest site in the world to pay them for something. I just want to like. Anyway, we won't get into that.
Yeah, we could have another conversation about that.
Gamersgate's probably a lot worse than Green Man Gaming.
Mm-hmm. All right, let's move on now to I guess our main feature for the podcast: our posts on game breaking mechanics. So, basically, by the time this podcast goes out, everyone should have already read the post, hopefully a few times. And what the focus on the post is about breaking the game. This is a term that I like to use for games where there are mechanics or strategies that are always up. When you get to the point that basically just renders the entire game just moot. It's just too easy. And it gets to the point with some games that you have to decide, do I use these tactics? Because they're proper gameplay. It's not like you're cheating the game or modding it. But at the same time, do I want to handicap my experience just to play a game with a reasonable amount of challenge? And one of the examples, I brought three good examples. First was FTL, which I know both Kenneth and Jason have played, including myself. And the example of that is that FTL, while it is a randomized roguelite, the final boss is always set. You're going to fight it the same way, so you use the same tactics every single time. And because of that, it leads to this game-breaking situation where if you know what weapons, what equipment to have, it makes the whole boss fight, you know, a piece of cake. I know that after I figured it out, I basically beat the game three times in a row after that. And it got to the point that I just stopped caring about playing FTL.
I was, I'll be honest with you, I know that you've created tactics, but I didn't beat it till like 40 hours in. Because I kept trying to beat the game using droids. Like, this'll do it. This'll do it. Like, nope. This'll never do it. Because they don't pinpoint things you need to pinpoint. They shoot things at random. I'm like, maybe this time. Okay, maybe this time. Hours and hours of saying that. It's like, maybe these droids will do it. No.
These are not the droids we're looking for.
Never the droids we're looking for. So I just beat with a normal ship with lasers. Way easier than droids.
Yeah, I had so much trouble too when I first started playing it. And then once I found that strategy, the whole fight, it was just like a snooze fest after that. Like, oh no, final boss. Dead. Like, I was like, alright, so now what do I have to do?
And play another game.
This is the problem when we have games that have set pieces. Because when you give the player freedom like that, freedom in set design is usually a recipe for disaster, I've seen. And, sure. And I know that we were all going to talk about Vampire the Masquerade, and I think Alpha Protocol regarding that too.
Well, if you want me to talk about Alpha Protocol, I can tell you why it was a broken game. Well, okay, let's just say in that game, there's a stealth mechanic in it, and I love games with stealth mechanics, but at some point, you can level up it so high that you're pretty much invisible to people. Like, they can't even see you. You're standing, yeah. You'd be breathing in their ear. Mm-hmm. They can't see you. And there's another move where you can level up where you just snap necks. So you just go around being invisible, snapping necks all over the place, no matter how hard the guy is. You go around, the guys, and also the AI is kind of stupid, so they're like, what's going on? Snap. What's going on? Snap. And the whole room's just dead. As invisible guy running around snapping necks. And that completely breaks the game in terms of any sort of challenge. Mm-hmm. The only time there is challenge is when it's unfair challenge in that game. Like, there's an example where, like, let's say you're stealth and snapping necks. Well, there's a boss that, like, jumps in is at range, and all you have is a shotgun now for some reason. And you can't turn invisible, and you can't snap necks. Then you're in trouble. But the rest of the game, it's just you being invisible snapping necks. And that's what they should rename the game.
Invisible dudes snapping necks.
Yep.
Well, you know, another problem I had, I guess, was that, like, what stealth looked like in that game was kind of hilarious with your guy, like, slightly hunched over. And then he would just...
It's a buggy game.
Yeah, he would just kind of, like, shuffle past people and they wouldn't see him. It was really baffling.
But as we know, that's how stealth works in real life. As long as you just hunch slightly over, you're invisible to people.
Listen, if you crouch, no one can hear you. Your footsteps, it's all a mask. It doesn't matter what you're stepping on.
One question I have for both of you. Like, as we talk about, there's always that temptation once you find a game grading mechanic just to, you know, exploit the hell element. So, if both of you, when that happens to you, do you just, you know, go full on use it, or do you try, you know, hold back and limit yourself?
I'll use it if there's something like immediately that I can use it for, but I try not to overuse stuff like that because it does kind of take some of the fun out of the game.
Yeah.
Except for the Sims. I mean, giving yourself money in the Sims is the only way to play the Sims.
Well, again, it's the concept of dominant strategy. Whatever works and the most effectively going to work, that people will just use. Like, example is like the Hadouken in Street Fighter. Like, they will just spam it. And then until there's an opponent that can't, that likes to dodge it, they won't change up their gameplay. And that's just, a natural habit of people, you know? As for me, personally, if there is a dominant strategy that is always effective, like snapping necks or lasers, whatever, I like to use the other options the designers gave me for variety's sake and start fooling around more than just trying to beat the game itself. And that's its own level of fun.
Sure. So, yeah, I can see that.
And for me, I've been trying to resist the temptation of playing while I'm playing King's Bounty Warriors of the North, because as I talked about earlier, they have it set up so that you have this freedom on one hand to build your character how you want. You can select your army from any composition that you want, but all the encounters are set every time. So when you have that, it makes it very easy to find a strategy that just flat out decimates everything. And as an example that I said in the blog post, like as Kendall was talking about, they rate the army matchup. So one guy could be easy or impossible and so on. And in one of them, I basically fought an army that was rated invincible. And I beat it without, you know, without a sweat. It's just an easy fight, even though it was rated impossible for me to actually win.
Now, did you guys play Fallen Enchantress?
I played it like once, but I didn't really get into it.
I really like that game, and it kind of has a real Heroes of Might and Magic feel to it.
You should say the history of it, Josh.
For those of you, I think I talked about this in one of like, our first podcasts, but for those of you who don't know, what happened was Elemental War on Magic, that was the original one. Yeah. I think this came out in 2010, I believe. Or 2011 by Stardock. And the game was just broken to ridiculous levels. Technically, it had game crashing bugs, memory leaks, the whole deal. Gameplay-wise, the single-player campaign didn't work. There were actual game systems that were just not utilized at all. Like, the whole diplomacy system was just, like, out of whack there. And it was so bad that the developers released a public apology, and they gave everyone who bought the game Fallen Enchantress for free.
Cool. I mean, yeah. I think that's a nice gesture, but... So this looks like they actually made a better game, so there we go.
Oh, well, yeah, Fallen Enchantress is designed by a friend of mine, John Schaefer. He's a really good designer, and they also had the guy that did a really famous Civ 4 or Civ 5 mod.
I think it's like, he does it for like each one. He's been doing it since
it's
Civ 3.
Heaven, it was something Heaven.
Fall from Heaven, I believe.
Fall from Heaven. And yeah, it's the guy's name is Derek something. I can't remember right now. But they're both really good designers, and Fallen Enchantress shows that. Because I think a lot of the stuff was there for a cool game, but it just hadn't been connected, because Brad Wardell, as much as he is, he's good at programming that kind of thing and designing that kind of thing. He's not particularly good at the game, as good at the gameplay systems as like John and Derek are. And they're, and it really shows too. It's got, so if anybody's played Master of Magic, this is like Master of Magic, except better. it's crazy. It's a good game.
And there's the other game I've been hearing people talk about, Eador, Masters of the New World, Masters of the Fallen World, something like that.
I have that too. I haven't. Well, I don't have the. There's a new one coming out. I have the old one, Eador Genesis. I don't have the new one.
Does anyone know the game? This is another random one, but does anyone know the game of Orcs and Men? Is that good?
I keep seeing that, and like, I'm kind of curious about it. Yeah, yeah, I see that. Like, I like the trailer.
Orcs and Goblins, something like that.
It's the one where like you play an orc, right? And you're it actually looks pretty cool. I mean, like story wise, concept wise.
It was on sale for $20. I'm like, maybe, but I don't know.
I kept thinking that too.
Yeah, I don't know.
Just at the price where we're like, I don't know. It's starting to become an investment.
I don't know.
I was looking for. I was waiting for. I keep seeing Fallen Enchantress. I'm like, man, I really want to try that game, but the price is always so high. It's like, oh man, it's $30. Even during the sales, it didn't go down. At least from my memory, it didn't go down.
Yeah, when you get a chance, grab it. I think you'll really like it if you're Heroes of Might and Magic.
I love Heroes of Might and Magic, so you've already sold it to me. Well, and it sounds like they're a good company, too, if they're willing to give everyone a free copy of Fallen Enchantress. So, you know.
Yeah, they have their issues. But,
well, yeah, every company has their issues.
There was a really nasty issue that happened last year with a sexual harassment lawsuit.
That company?
Yeah. Let's I think, to talk about it in this one. So, yeah, they definitely had some PR issues.
Ooh, man, that's weird. This isn't a Japanese company. What's going on here? The guy that made Ninja Gaiden or whatever, the other one. He was
sexual
harassment. Sexual harassment that was from that guy.
As a quick aside, I did find the name. It's Ador Masters of the Broken World. That's the new one that's coming out. The first one, Ador Genesis, I think, that's currently available on Google Games to buy.
Yeah, I picked that up like a couple of weeks ago, and I've like tinkered with it, but I haven't played it very much yet. Looks cool, though.
Yeah, I'm waiting for the sequels. I figure that one will be more fine. It'll be easier to understand than the first one.
Oh, I'm sure. I mean, did you ever play Dominion? Like, or Dominions
the card,
1?
The card game?
No. Oh, God, no. PC game. I mean, some people are going to get mad at me for calling it a horrible PC game, but it's just...
I've heard of it. Dominions. It's like one by Illwinter, I think that's the company.
Or something like that. Like, I remember... Well, it became a big deal on like 2 to 3 years back, and you had to like mail order it at the time, which was awful. But I did so, and it's one of those games that has like it comes with like a 400-page instruction book.
Yeah,
you know, it's ASCII graphics.
Oh my god! Yeah, I remember.
Sounds amazing.
It is like that's like one of those incomprehensible games I've ever tried to play.
It's a Bruce Garrick game, if that makes sense to anybody. It's a total Bruce Garrick game. He's totally like Mr. Big Time War Game Strategy guy. You know?
Oh my god! The other day, I went to a I think it was a competition, a championship for board games. It's like the East Coast's biggest championship board game thing for a friend. And they had just tables and tables of all these games I've never heard of. And it looked super complicated. Like, tons of pieces, tons of, like... Now, that it wasn't... It was a lot of it was just, like, war simulation board games.
Yeah, those are the ones that have the least exciting pieces. They're always, like, flat circles or chips and stuff like that.
When I was younger, I just thought, like, Warhammer was the most complicated thing. But looking at these things, I'm like, is insanely complicated, and I don't even know where to start. And it smells in here.
Well, right. I mean, no, but yeah, Warhammer is one of those games that, like, once you get like the basics of it, it's actually pretty simple. But yeah, no, those war games get a little crazy. Some of them take days to play.
For some reason, my friend was into this. He was competing in this ship game. You play like, you know, an old school sailing ship from like 1700s, and you would have naval battles. And it was kind of like FTL. You had like different like little rooms and different things that control different parts of the ship and the sails and rudders and like all these different mechanics or just all these nuances of sailing in the form of a board game.
Not bad. With Dominions, I think Bruce wrote a tutorial for Dominions too that I actually tried to follow and that was like still over my head. And I think he wrote the manual or tutorial for Dominions 3.
Yeah, no, I know he wrote that huge tutorial. I went through that too. It was probably just that I wasn't into it. Because, like, I love Dwarf Fortress. Totally all about Dwarf Fortress. I play it all the time. It's a super complicated game as well.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. It's just so, God, that Dominions game. Yeah, if Bruce writes something for it, you know it's a serious ordeal. You know, it's not going to be like a pendant or like, you know, pretzels and peanuts kind of game.
Yeah. So whenever I see like a wall of text, my brain just shuts up. I'm like, no, don't.
Yeah.
No. So that's me. So
I guess we're now going to be boycotted by the war game community after saying all the stuff about Dominions 3.
I didn't say anything. I have never played Dominion. I'm out of this.
Yeah, I don't blame you.
Now there's one area of game breaking that I find fascinating is when the developers actually embrace it. And this goes back to my example of Disgaea. Have either of you played Disgaea?
Oh, yes. That's one of my favorite PS2 games. I have that one still.
Nope. I've only seen it from afar.
What they do is, the game itself is like your typical strategy RPG. You move your units around the map, that kind of deal.
Like Final Fantasy Tactics kind of thing. Mm-hmm.
And the twist of the game is that it has a bunch of extra systems involving improving your character. Like, they have every item in the game, equipment, weapons, whatever, has a randomized dungeon that you can go into, and each floor you clear will level the item up. And then, of course, you can level up your guys inside these dungeons, too. And then you can, like, take a character and upgrade their... You set them back a little one, but with higher stats. And there's just all these little different systems that can make your characters overpowered. And when I say overpowered, I mean to the point that it makes, like, the main quest just ridiculously easy. Like, you could just, like, kill, like, the final boss in, like, one hit from your weakest character easy.
You know, for me, it's reminiscent of, like, Knights of the Round or whatever in Final Fantasy VII, where if you spend all that time building up, it's just kind of a joke breeze through the rest of the game. It really is.
And what they do is that the main game, though, you can play this guy without using any of those extra systems, and you'll still enjoy the game that way. Or you can play with that and beat the main game relatively quickly, and then you unlock all the post-game super hard challenges. Like, you'll fight, like, enemies who are, like, level 5,000 in that.
Oh, yes. Those games are great. Actually, that whole series of games, like, kind of spiritual series, it's not... I mean, well, I guess there is this guy up to 4 now, which is weird, but what I mean by that's like Phantom Brave.
Yeah.
God. I have all of this. I cannot remember. Lapuselle Tactics.
You need to try all these one day.
Mekai Kingdoms is actually really cool, too. That's one of their weirder ones, Mekai Kingdoms, but I'll say Phantom Brave's up there as well.
Yeah, each one has, like, a different, like, system of progression. Like,
yeah.
Mekai Kingdom, I think you could... I forget, like...
You summon buildings. Like, it's that, like, sounds, you summon, like, taverns and stuff like that.
That sounds amazing.
Yeah, that one's awesome. Like, Phantom Brave is you summon ghosts, but you have to make them possess, like, rocks and trees and stuff like that, and whatever they possess... alters their physical stats when they're in the world, so if they possess rock, they're harder to kill, you know, they're tougher and all that.
This gives me an idea. Train simulator with ghost possession.
That would be awesome.
Pokemon are train cars.
Ghostbusters 2 subway simulator, so you just drive a ghost train under New York all night.
I love it. You have to be like, it has to be real sad while you play the game, so it empowers the slime.
Yes. So. Yes.
Or angry. Sad or angry. Throughout the entire train ride.
I think you'd probably be angry if you were playing that game all night.
Actually, my thesis, my thesis project when I was in school was on brain-computer interface devices and using them within game spaces. So that's actually possible. We could actually put on like an FNIR or an EEG device and use that to power our train.
I got it. You have, like, a microphone. You sound awesome. Screams increases the speed of the train.
I like it. Guys, we're going to revolutionize the train simulation business. Let's go for it.
We're going to
train simulator, it's run off of hatred and fear.
Pretty much.
That is the greatest thing I've ever heard. I think we would make $12 at least.
Yeah.
And then after that, after that, zombie DLC. But then we're in the millions and billions.
Yeah, that's really neat.
We'll enter the exciting competing market of train simulators.
Yeah.
Then we could move over into truck simulators, because Euro Truck Simulator is doing pretty well as well.
Yeah. And then after that, we pick something that's like way off the radar, and we'll do like Marvel Madness Simulator, where you're actually playing the ball, so it's really disorienting.
Oh.
Gives you a seizure every time you play it. That would be...
I love how we're making business plans on our podcast. Perfect.
Yes.
I like the direction site's going.
We're doing this now.
But, you know, back to just, like, broken game mechanics. So, Borderlands 2, Macromancer.
Mm.
It's just wow. I mean...
Yep.
He is the most overpowered thing.
Awesome. I don't need co-op play anymore. I just have my little like robot take care of everything.
Yeah, you just hide behind a barrel or something or a box, and then just summon the robot, and hey, game over.
No, it's actually a pretty cool indicator because what happens is when all the guys are gone, he comes back. He's like, "Yo, dog." I'm like, "Oh, we're done with this area. Okay, let's move on."
Yeah,
I mean the robot flies. It shoots lasers, so it hits airborne things. It does like its whole little attack, and it lasts for such a long time. I think it lasts longer than the turn.
Yes.
But the revive takes the reuse it takes a long time.
Not really, not as long as other things. And you get skills that lower it. There's like one skill, I think it's in the best friend tree, that each time you kill an enemy, it increases duration. I just can't imagine like doing that, because it'll just be around definitely. I think at that point.
No, I want to play a game with four like Mechamancers, or whatever they're called, and see how that goes.
Oh, God.
Bunch of huge death robots coming at us.
About as exciting as like four commandos, probably.
sounds like a game I like to play. Should give it a shot.
And like Jason, like the first time we were playing, like he says, like, "Do you think she's overpowered?" Like first time we saw like the robots kill her, like. I guess, I mean, it's alright. And then, like, 10 minutes later, we were fighting, like, a boss. And we were just, like,
staying aside.
Yeah, we were just, like, staying aside. He was just running around killing the area of the boss. I'm like, okay, yeah, I think it's a little overpowered now.
Oh, yeah, I did the same thing. You're talking about Boom Boom, right?
And then we were in, like, the DLC, so it was, like, one of like, the pirate bosses.
Okay, because when Boom Boom came, I was like, alright, robot, and just blew up. I'm like, alright, what happened? Well, it's dead now, okay.
Yeah, Boom Boom's kind of a joke anyway. I always kill, like, the little Boom on accident before I mean to, or, like, even notice, you know? So it's always like, well, I don't get that boss fight. But it does let you shoot Claptrap with the cannon directly afterwards.
Yeah.
I actually waited so I didn't have to shoot him. I was like, what would happen if I just waited? And he's all like, he tells you, I'm bored, shoot the gate eventually.
Yeah, I did that. Claptrap has some great extra dialogue that I'm sure most people don't hear.
Yeah, probably miss it too, because I'm impatient like that whenever I hear text or I hear like voice, I'm like, okay, just skip, because I've always been a quick reader, so I'm just like reading all the text underneath it.
Oh, yeah.
So one that just drives me nuts in the game is, this is of course a quick aside, is when you have like, you see like the text, but you hear them talking, and you can't move on to the next thing until they're finished talking, even though you just read their entire sentence.
Yeah, that's in, like, all the Japanese RPGs.
Mm-hmm.
Like, Final Fantasy XIV, thank you for horrible cutscenes. No voice acting, all cutscenes, all slow, all terrible. I have PTSD from that game, I swear. I was in the month beta before it released, and I was all like, this is not a game. They can't release this, and they released it. I'm like, oh, you dumbs.
Can you guys think of any other series that actually makes use of good game breaking mechanics?
A lot of board games is what I can think of. But like that's kind of a board game thing nowadays. It's like they love taking like game mechanics and then giving your special powers completely game breaking, but everybody else's hours are game-breaking in different ways, so... Right. For instance, like the Penny Arcade card game for the iPad or whatever, every like character you play as has a different like game-breaking power. So I think if it's used in, like, actual, you know, kind of context or used as part of the design, it can be a great part. But otherwise, it can also just kind of ruin a game. So.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I think if the developers are aware and they work it into their systems, then it should be okay. But, you know, I think the only time when it really matters, if it's really game-breaking and it's going to hurt the game overall, is if it's a multiplayer game. If it's
absolutely
an online game. Because the environment has to be fair for all players. Everyone should have the same access to all the controls. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? So.
No, yeah, absolutely. And that's really the only time they should be concerned about it. I mean, unless, of course, the game breaking specifically actually breaks the game. To the point you can't play it anymore. I mean,
yeah, that happens.
Right. Yeah. I think it's a much bigger concern in the MMO community than anywhere else.
No, definitely. Yeah. But I say we should actually start wrapping it up because we're degrading in quality and it's already been an hour.
I do have one more thing I want to bring up about game breaking, about when it happens in single player games in the wrong way, like the Vampire the Masquerade example. do you want to just end the call? We'll do just one more recall.
Oh, that's fine with me. Yeah. Whatever.
No, we'll just continue on. That's okay. We'll sound a little funky at the end. But honestly, like with the Bloodlines, it was buggy. It was bad, I guess, but it still has a special place in my heart because they did put a good effort trying a brand new engine, and but you know, and they just had too much pressure from the publishers just to release it, and there was literal game breaking bugs where you get trapped on quests or you couldn't defeat a quest and you know all that stuff like that, and the community itself had to create patches to make it work. Mm-hmm. That's the crazy thing.
So what I want to talk about in terms of game-breaking with Vampire the Masquerade, and this goes into the issue with giving the player freedom in a set environment. And what we talked about earlier is that on one hand, the player can find a way to just supersede all the difficulty and all the challenge. But on the other hand, if they're not careful, they can basically just ruin the game, make it impossible due to their choices. And with Vampire the Masquerade Bloodlines, what happened was, it was a game that allowed you to play the game. You could be stealthy, you could combat, you could try to talk your way out of doing any kind of fighting. And the actual combat system, which I think was based on pen and paper systems, was that the weapons themselves receive a bonus based on any points you put into them. And these bonuses get really big. Like, for instance, you could use, like, your bare hands and do more damage with your bare hands than with, like, a machine gun if you put points into, you know, unarmed combat.
Guns are worthless in that game anyways.
Yeah. And what ends up happening is that for the first half of the game, they give you a lot of choices. You have a lot of freedom in how to get around. And then I think it was, like, when you went to, like, L.A. or Hollywood, I forget, when they start introducing more combat situations and boss fights that you can't do anything other than fight. And what happened was, if you spend your whole time building your character without any combat skills whatsoever, these fights were effectively impossible for you. You basically broke the game for yourself because there's just no way to get around not having those combat traits.
Sounds like a Deus Ex problem, too.
Yeah. And this is why I believe that game-breaking mechanics either work when you are either aware of them, like with Disgaea, or it's harder to game-break when you're dealing with both player freedom and randomized challenges. Something like a traditional strategy game, like Crusader Kings or the Total War series.
Yeah, I completely agree with that. I'm just saying that when you have it open like that, there's scenarios that you don't factor in as a designer, and, you know, that's why testing is so very important. And it's as more people say, why doesn't this game just go open world? Well, there's a lot of difficulty that goes into it, and you don't have control over the narrative structure, all stuff like that.
Yeah.
Not as much, you know what I mean?
Mm-hmm. And we also see when you give a player freedom, this is also where you have, like, unintentional difficulty spikes, like with Deus Ex. Like, the majority of the game is pretty easy to get through, but then, of course, each boss fight was just, you know, like a Mount Everest-sized amount of challenge for people who weren't spec for combat.
Or weren't prepared for it, but
I just kept the these weapons called the Typhoon, where he spins around in circles and shoots lots of bombs. I just kept them for the only reason of defeating bosses. That's it. I never used them at all in any other part of the game, because it killed things. So, that in itself could tell you that it's broken. And I think that it's the biggest killer of it, other than the ending.
Well, that's a discussion for another podcast.
All right.
And one of them all.
Voices are degrading.
All right.
Rule out.
All right. So, that will do it for us for this week. I would like to thank Jason and Ken for being on.
Yoy.
And we'll, of course, be happy to have you back anytime, Jason.
Oh, I'll be back.
And for those of you listening, if you are interested in coming on for the podcast, either just to talk to us or to spotlight a game you're working on, whatever, just send us an email. You can see the link on our front page, and we'll be happy to talk with you. Do you have anything else to add, Kenneth?
Nope.
All right. So, that will do it for us. Thank you for listening to the Perceptive Podcast, and we will talk to you again next week.